park and scheduled their reservations for dinner. Another bit of technology helped them enjoy their favorite rides while minimizing waiting time. Back inside their hotel room at the end of the day, there was a final twist. A digital picture frame had automatically downloaded a picture of them as they rode a Disney World roller coaster. Stone Yamashita, working with HP's engineers, turned a message about the benefits of collaboration, what could have been a PowerPoint presentation, into a living, breathing simulation. Stone Yamashita put hooks into the idea of e-services. They took an abstract idea and made it concrete with an intense sensory experience. Note that there were two different audiences for the exhibit. The first audience was Disney. Disney's execs were the novices. They needed to be shown in tangible terms what HP's technology could do for them. Then there were HP's employees, particularly the engineers. They were far from novices. Many engineers had been skeptical about the value of Yamashita's demos. Once the exhibit opened, however, it produced tremendous enthusiasm within HP. It was initially intended to stay up long enough to make the Disney pitch, but because it was so popular, it remained for 3 or 4 months afterward. One observer said, "It became very viral in that others began to ask, 'Did you see that great thing that the labs team did? Did you know that we could do this? Did you know that they did it in only 28 days? Concreteness helped this team of experts coordinate. A diverse group of engineers, accustomed to contemplating difficult technology problems, suddenly came face to face with the Ferrari family. By grappling with one family's concrete needs, their tickets and reservations and photos, they did something remarkable. They took abstract ideas from their research labs and turned them into a family picture on a roller coaster ride." Concrete brings knowledge to bear. White things. Grab a pencil and a piece of paper and find a way to time yourself. A watch, a spouse who likes to count, etc. Here is a do-it-yourself test on concreteness. You'll do 2 brief 15-second exercises. When you've got your supplies ready, set your timer for 15 seconds, then follow the instructions for step 1. Step 1 instructions. Write down as many things that are white in color as you can think of. Stop. Reset your timer for 15 seconds. Step 2 instructions. Write down as many white things in your refrigerator as you can think of. Most people, remarkably, can list about as many white things from their refrigerators as white anythings. This result is stunning because, well, our fridges don't include a particularly large part of the universe. Even people who list more white anythings often feel that the refrigerator test is easier. Why does this happen? Because concreteness is a way of mobilizing and focusing your brain. For another example of this phenomenon, consider these two statements. 1. Think of 5 silly things that people have done in the world in the past 10 years. 2. Think about 5 silly things your child has done in the past 10 years. Sure, this is a neat brain trick, but what value does it have? Consider a situation where an entrepreneur used this neat brain trick to earn a $4.5 million investment from a savvy and sophisticated group of investors. Kaplan and Go Computers. For an entrepreneur, having the chance to pitch a business idea to local venture capitalists is a big deal, like a budding actor getting an audition with an independent film director. But having a chance to pitch an idea to Kleiner Perkins, the most prestigious firm in Silicon Valley, is more like a private one-on-one audition with Steven Spielberg. You could walk out a star, or you could walk out having blown the biggest chance of your life. And that's why 29-year-old Jerry Kaplan was nervous as he stood in the Kleiner Perkins office in early 1987. His presentation would start in about 30 minutes. Kaplan was a former researcher at Stanford who had quit to work at Lotus in its early days. Lotus, with its best-selling Lotus 1-2-3 spreadsheet, became a stock market darling. Now Kaplan was ready for the next challenge. He had a vision for a smaller, more portable generation of personal computers. He hung around outside the conference room as the previous entrepreneur finished his presentation. Watching the other entrepreneur, he felt underprepared. As he observed, his nervousness advanced toward panic. The other entrepreneur wore a dark pinstriped suit with a red power tie. Kaplan had on a sport jacket with an open-collared shirt. The other entrepreneur was projecting an impressive color graph onto the whiteboard. Kaplan was carrying a maroon portfolio with a blank pad of paper inside. This did not bode well. Kaplan had thought that he was showing up for an informal get-to-know-you session. But standing there, he realized how naive he'd been. He had no business plan, no slides, no charts, no financial projections, no prototypes. Worst of all, the uber-prepared entrepreneur in the boardroom was facing a skeptical audience that now peppered him with tough questions. When Kaplan's turn arrived, one of the partners introduced him. Kaplan took a deep breath and started, "I believe that a new type of computer, more like a notebook than a typewriter, and operated by a pen rather than a keyboard, will serve the needs of professionals like ourselves when we are away from our desks. We will use them to take notes, send and receive messages through cellular telephone links, look up addresses, phone numbers, price lists, and inventories, do spreadsheet calculations, and fill out order forms." He covered the required technology, highlighting the major unknown: whether a machine could reliably recognize handwriting and convert it into commands. Kaplan recounts what happened next. "My audience seemed tense. I couldn't tell whether they were annoyed by my lack of preparation or merely concentrating on what I was saying. Thinking I had already blown it and therefore had little to lose, I decided to risk some theatrics. If I were carrying a portable PC right now, you would sure as hell know it. You probably didn't realize that I am holding a model of the future of computing right here in my hands." I tossed my maroon leather case in the air. It sailed to the center of the table where it landed with a loud clap. "Gentlemen, here is a model of the next step in the computer revolution." For a moment, I thought this final act of drama might get me thrown out of the room. They were sitting in stunned silence, staring at my plain leather folder, which lay motionless on the table, as though it were suddenly going to come to life. Brooke Byers, the youthful-looking but long-time partner in the firm, slowly reached out and touched the portfolio, as if it were some sort of talisman. He asked the first question: "Just how much information could you store in something like this?" John Doer, another partner, answered before I could respond. "It doesn't matter. Memory chips are getting smaller and cheaper each year, and the capacity will probably double for the same size and price annually." Someone else chimed in: "But bear in mind, John, that unless you translate the handwriting efficiently, it's likely to take up a lot more room." The speaker was Vinod Khosla, the founding CEO of Sun Microsystems, who helped the partnership evaluate technology deals. Kaplan said that from that point on, he hardly had to speak, as partners and associates traded questions and insights that fleshed out his proposal. Periodically, he said, someone would reach out to touch or examine his portfolio. It had been magically transformed from a stationary store accessory into a symbol of the future of technology. A few days later, Kaplan got a call from Kleiner Perkins. The partners had decided to back the idea. Their investment valued Kaplan's non-existent company at $4.5 million. What transformed this meeting from a grill session with an anxious entrepreneur in the hot seat to a brainstorming session? The maroon portfolio. The portfolio presented a challenge to the boardroom participants, a way of focusing their thoughts and bringing their existing knowledge to bear. It changed their attitude from reactive and critical to active and creative. The presence of the portfolio made it easier for the venture capitalists to brainstorm, in the same way that focusing on white things in our refrigerator made it easier for us to brainstorm. When they saw the size of the portfolio, it sparked certain questions. How much memory could you fit in that thing? Which PC components will shrink in the next few years and which won't? What new technology would have to be invented to make it feasible? This same process was sparked in Sony's Japanese engineering team by the concept of a pocketable radio. Concreteness creates a shared turf on which people can collaborate. Everybody in the room feels comfortable that they're tackling the same challenge. Even experts, even the Kleiner Perkins venture capitalists, the rock stars of the technology world, benefit from concrete talk that puts them on common ground. Clinic. Oral rehydration therapy saves children's lives. The situation. Each year, more than 1 million children in countries around the world die from dehydration caused by diarrhea. This problem can be prevented, at very low cost, by getting kids the right kind of fluids. How do you get people invested in this idea? Message 1. Here's an explanation from PSI, a nonprofit group that addresses health problems in developing countries. Diarrhea is one of the leading killers of young children in developing countries, causing over 1.5 million child deaths annually. Diarrhea itself is not the cause of death, but rather dehydration, the loss of body fluid. Approximately 3/4 of the body is composed of water, and if fluid loss exceeds 10% of total body fluid, vital organs collapse, followed by death. If an episode is severe, as with cholera, death can occur within just 8 hours. To prevent life-threatening dehydration, it is necessary to increase liquid intake in quantities sufficient to replenish the fluids and electrolytes lost with diarrhea. The best liquid for this purpose is a blend of electrolytes, sugar, and water, known as oral rehydration salts. ORS restores body fluid and electrolytes more rapidly than any other liquid, and does so even when the intestinal wall is compromised by disease. Comments on message 1. Quick, how solvable is this problem? Suppose you were a health official in a developing nation. What would you do tomorrow to start saving kids? To be fair, this message appears on a web page that describes what PSI has been doing to solve this problem. The text doesn't necessarily reflect how the organization might approach decision-makers to persuade them to act. The information is written in language that creates credibility. There is lots of scientific language and exposition. If the problem sounds too complex, however, that could deter people from trying to solve it. Message 2. This message is from James Grant, who was the director of UNICEF for many years. Grant always traveled with a packet filled with 1 teaspoon of salt and 8 teaspoons of sugar, the ingredients for oral rehydration therapy, ORT, when mixed with 1 liter of water. When he met with the prime ministers of developing countries, he would take out his packet of salt and sugar and say, "Do you know that this costs less than a cup of tea, and it can save hundreds of thousands of children's lives in your country?" Comments on message 2. Quick. How solvable is this problem? What are you going to do tomorrow to start saving these children's lives? Grant's message brings you to the table, helps you bring your knowledge to bear. Maybe you're brainstorming ways of getting salt sugar packets to schools. Maybe you're thinking about publicity campaigns to teach mothers the right ratio of salt and sugar. Grant is clearly a master of making ideas stick. He brings out a concrete prop and starts with an attention-grabbing, unexpected contrast. This packet costs less than a cup of tea, but it can have a real impact. Prime ministers spend their time thinking about elaborate, complex social problems. Building infrastructure, constructing hospitals, maintaining a healthy environment. And suddenly, here's a bag of salt and sugar that can save hundreds of thousands of children. Grant's message does sacrifice the statistics and the scientific description that add credibility to the PSI message. But, as the director of UNICEF, he had enough credibility to keep people from questioning his facts. So Grant left the uncontested factual battle behind and fought the motivational battle. His bag of salt and sugar is the equivalent of Kaplan's maroon portfolio in the venture capital presentation. It helps the members of the audience bring their expertise to the problem. You can't see it and not start brainstorming about the possibilities. Punchline. This clinic is one of our favorite before and after examples in the book because it shows how powerful a concrete idea can be. The moral is to find some way to invite people to the table, to help them bring their knowledge to bear. Here, a prop works better than a scientific description. Making ideas concrete. How do we move toward concrete ideas for our own messages? We might find our own decisions easier to make if they are guided by the needs of specific people, our readers, our students, our customers. General Mills is one of the world's largest manufacturers of consumer products. Its brands include Pillsbury, Cheerios, Green Giant, Betty Crocker, Chex, and many others. One of the largest brands in the company, from a sales perspective, is Hamburger Helper. Melissa Studzinski, a 28-year-old from Michigan, joined General Mills in 2004 as Hamburger Helper's brand manager. When she joined the team, Hamburger Helper had been in a decade-long slump. The CEO, frustrated by the decline, announced that his number one goal for 2005 was to fix and grow the Hamburger Helper brand. Studzinski, the newest person on the team, was eager to tackle the challenge. When she started the job, she was given three huge binders full of data and stats. Sales and volume data, advertising strategy briefs, product information, and market research and the brand's customers. The binders were difficult to pick up, let alone absorb into memory. She called them the death binders. A few months later, Studzinski's team decided to put the data aside and try something new. They made plans to send members of the Hamburger Helper team, marketing, advertising, and R&D staffers, out into the homes of Hamburger Helper customers. The idea was known informally as fingertips, because the General Mills employees needed to have a picture of the brand's customers at their fingertips. A call went out for mothers, the predominant customers of Hamburger Helper, who were willing to let strangers come into their homes and gawk at them while they cooked. The team visited 2 to 3 dozen homes. Studzinski visited 3 homes, and the experience stuck with her. I had read and I could recite all the data about our customers, she says. I knew their demographics by heart, but it was a very different experience to walk into a customer's home and experience a little bit of her life. I'll never forget one woman who had a toddler on her hip while she was mixing up dinner on the stove. We know that convenience is an important attribute of our product, but it's a different thing to see the need for convenience firsthand. Most of all, Studzinski learned that moms and their kids really valued predictability. Hamburger Helper had 11 different pasta shapes, but kids didn't care about different shapes. What they did care about was flavor. And moms just wanted to buy the same predictable flavor their kids wouldn't reject. But Hamburger Helper had more than 30 different flavors, and moms struggled to find their favorites among the massive grocery store displays. Food and beverage companies constantly pushed to develop new flavors and packages, but Studzinski needed to resist this push. Moms saw new flavors as risky, she says. Using this concrete information about moms and kids, the team convinced a diverse collection of people across the organization in groups ranging from supply chain and manufacturing to finance to simplify the product line. According to Studzinski, the cost savings were huge, yet moms were happier because it was easier to find their family's favorites on grocery store shelves. The insight to simplify the product line, along with other key insights concerning pricing and advertising, sparked a turnaround for the brand. At the end of fiscal year 2005, Hamburger Helper's sales had increased 11%. Studzinski says, "Now when I've got a decision to make about the brand, I think of the women I met. I wonder what they would do if they were in my shoes. And it's amazing how helpful it is to think that way." The same philosophy is just as useful for ideas that are more transcendent. The Saddleback Church is a very successful church in a suburb of Irvine, California, that has grown to more than 50,000 members. Over the years, the church's leaders have created a detailed picture of the kind of person they're trying to reach. They call him Saddleback Sam. Here's how Rick Warren, the minister of Saddleback Church, describes him. Saddleback Sam is the typical unchurched man who lives in our area. His age is late 30s or early 40s. He has a college degree and may have an advanced degree. He is married to Saddleback Samantha, and they have two kids, Steve and Sally. Surveys show that Sam likes his job, he likes where he lives, and he thinks he's enjoying life more now than he was 5 years ago. He's self-satisfied, even smug about his station in life. He's either a professional, a manager, or a successful entrepreneur. Another important characteristic of Sam is that he's skeptical of what he calls organized religion. He's likely to say, "I believe in Jesus. I just don't like organized religion." The profile goes into much greater depth. Sam and Samantha's tastes in pop culture, their preferences about social events, and so on. What does Saddleback Sam accomplish for church leaders? Sam forces them to view their decisions through a different lens. Say someone proposes a telemarketing campaign to local community members. It sounds as if it has a great potential to reach new people. But the leaders know from their research that Sam hates telemarketers, so the idea is scratched. And thinking about Saddleback Sam and Samantha isn't limited to church leaders. There are hundreds of small ministries at the Saddleback Church. Grade school classes, Mother's Day Out programs, a men's basketball league. All are led by volunteer members who don't receive day-to-day direction from paid church staff. But these diverse programs work together because people throughout the church know whom they're trying to reach. Most of our members would have no trouble describing Sam, Warren says. By making Saddleback Sam and Samantha a living, breathing, concrete presence in the minds of the members of the Saddleback Church, the church has managed to reach 50,000 real Sams and Samanthas. Of the six traits of stickiness that we review in this book, concreteness is perhaps the easiest to embrace. It may also be the most effective of the traits. To be simple, to find our core message is quite difficult. It's certainly worth the effort, but let's not kid ourselves that it's easy. Crafting our ideas in an unexpected way takes a fair amount of effort and applied creativity, but being concrete isn't hard, and it doesn't require a lot of effort. The barrier is simply forgetfulness. We forget that we're slipping into abstract speak. We forget that other people don't know what we know. We're the engineers who keep flipping back to our drawings, not noticing that the assemblers just want us to follow them down to the factory floor. Chapter 4. Credible. Over the course of a lifetime, one person in 10 will develop an ulcer. Duodenal ulcers, the most common type, are almost never fatal, but they are extremely painful. For a long time, the cause of ulcers was a mystery. Conventional wisdom held that ulcers developed when surplus acid built up in the stomach, eating through the stomach wall. Such surplus acid could be caused, it was thought, by stress, spicy foods, or lots of alcohol. Ulcer treatments traditionally focused on mitigating the painful symptoms, since there was no clear way to cure an ulcer. In the early 1980s, two medical researchers from Perth, Australia, made an astonishing discovery. Ulcers are caused by bacteria. The researchers, Barry Marshall and Robin Warren, identified a tiny spiral-shaped type of bacteria as the culprit. It would later be named Helicobacter pylori, or H. pylori. The significance of this discovery was enormous. If ulcers were caused by bacteria, they could be cured. In fact, they could be cured within a matter of days by a simple treatment with antibiotics. The medical world, however, did not rejoice. There were no celebrations for Marshall and Warren, who had almost single-handedly improved the health prospects of several hundred million human beings. The reason for the lack of acclaim was simple. No one believed them. There were several problems with the bacteria story. The first problem was common sense. The acid in the stomach is potent stuff. It can obviously eat through a thick steak, and it's, less obviously, strong enough to dissolve a nail. It was ludicrous to think that bacteria could survive in such an environment. It would be like stumbling across an igloo in the Sahara. The second problem was the source. At the time of the discovery, Robin Warren was a staff pathologist at a hospital in Perth. Barry Marshall was a 30-year-old internist in training, not even a doctor yet. The medical community expects important discoveries to come from PhDs at research universities or professors at large, world-class medical centers. Internists do not cure diseases that affect 10% of the world's population. The final problem was the location. A medical researcher in Perth is like a physicist from Mississippi. Science is science, but thanks to basic human snobbery, we tend to think it will emerge from some places but not others. Marshall and Warren could not even get their research paper accepted by a medical journal. When Marshall presented their findings at a professional conference, the scientists snickered. One of the researchers, who heard one of his presentations, commented that he simply didn't have the demeanor of a scientist. To be fair to the skeptics, they had a reasonable argument. Marshall and Warren's evidence was based on correlation, not causation. Almost all of the ulcer patients seemed to have H. pylori. Unfortunately, there were also people who had H. pylori but no ulcer. And as for proving causation, the researchers couldn't very well dose a bunch of innocent people with bacteria to see whether they sprouted ulcers. By 1984, Marshall's patients had run out. One morning, he skipped breakfast and asked his colleagues to meet him in the lab. While they watched in horror, he chugged a glass filled with about a billion H. pylori. "It tasted like swamp water," he said. Within a few days, Marshall was experiencing pain, nausea, and vomiting, the classic symptoms of gastritis, the early stage of an ulcer. Using an endoscope, his colleagues found that his stomach lining, previously pink and healthy, was now red and inflamed. Like a magician, Marshall then cured himself with a course of antibiotics and bismuth, the active ingredient in Pepto-Bismol. Even after this dramatic demonstration, the battle wasn't over. Other scientists quibbled with the demonstration. Marshall had cured himself before he developed a full-blown ulcer, they argued, so maybe he had just generated ulcer symptoms rather than a genuine ulcer. But Marshall's demonstration gave a second wind to supporters of the bacteria theory, and subsequent research amassed more and more evidence in its favor. In 1994, 10 years later, the National Institutes of Health finally endorsed the idea that antibiotics were the preferred treatment for ulcers. Marshall and Warren's research contributed to an important theme in modern medicine, that bacteria and viruses cause more diseases than we would think. It is now known that cervical cancer is caused by the contagious human papillomavirus, or HPV. Certain types of heart disease have been linked to cytomegalovirus, a common virus that infects about 2/3 of the population. In the fall of 2005, Marshall and Warren received the Nobel Prize in Medicine for their work. These two men had a brilliant, Nobel-worthy, world-changing insight. So why did Marshall have to poison himself to get people to believe him? Finding credibility. Let's pose the question in the broadest possible terms. What makes people believe ideas? How's that for an ambitious question? Let's start with the obvious answers. We believe because our parents or our friends believe. We believe because we've had experiences that led us to our beliefs. We believe because of our religious faith. We believe because we trust authorities. These are powerful forces. Family, personal experience, faith. And thankfully, we have no control over the way these forces affect people. We can't root our memos through people's mothers to add credibility. We can't construct a PowerPoint presentation that will nullify people's core beliefs. If we're trying to persuade a skeptical audience to believe a new message, the reality is that we're fighting an uphill battle against a lifetime of personal learning and social relationships. It would seem that there's nothing much we can do to affect what people believe. But if we're skeptical about our ability to affect belief, we merely have to look at naturally sticky ideas because some of them persuade us to believe some pretty incredible things. Around 1999, an email message spread over the internet, forwarded from person to person, claiming that shipments of bananas from Costa Rica were infected with necrotizing fasciitis, otherwise known as flesh-eating bacteria. People were warned not to purchase bananas for the next 3 weeks and urged to seek medical attention if they contracted a rash after eating a banana. The email also warned, "The skin infection from necrotizing fasciitis is very painful and eats 2 to 3 centimeters of flesh per hour. Amputation is likely. Death is possible." It claimed that the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, was reluctant to issue a general warning because it feared a nationwide panic. One would think that disappearing centimeters of flesh might be sufficient to cause a panic, even in the absence of the FDA's response. This surprising message was attributed to the Mannheim Research Institute. This bizarre rumor spread at least in part because it had an air of authority. It was circulated by the Mannheim Research Institute, and the Food and Drug Administration knew about the problem. The Mannheim Research Institute and the FDA are invoked as credibility boosters. Their authority makes us think twice about what would otherwise be some pretty incredible statements. Necrotizing fasciitis consumes 3 centimeters of flesh per hour? If that's true, why isn't the story on the evening news? Evidently, someone realized that the rumor's credibility could be improved. Later versions added, "This message has been verified by the Centers for Disease Control." If the rumor circulated long enough, no doubt it would eventually be approved by the Dalai Lama and heartily endorsed by the Security Council. As the contaminated bananas show, authorities are a reliable source of credibility for our ideas. When we think of authorities who can add credibility, we tend to think of 2 kinds of people. The first kind is the expert, the kind of person whose wall is covered with framed credentials. Oliver Sacks for neuroscience, Alan Greenspan for economics, or Stephen Hawking for physics. Celebrities and other aspirational figures make up the second class of authorities. Why do we care that Michael Jordan likes McDonald's? Certainly he is not a certified nutritionist or a world-class gourmet. We care because we want to be like Mike. And if Mike likes McDonald's, so do we. If Oprah likes a book, it makes us more interested in that book. We trust the recommendations of people whom we want to be like. If you have access to the endorsement of Stephen Hawking or Michael Jordan, renowned experts or celebrities, skip this part of the chapter. As for the rest of us, whom can we call on? Can we find external sources of credibility that don't involve celebrities or experts? The answer, surprisingly, is yes. We can tap the credibility of anti-authorities. One anti-authority was a woman named Pam Laffin. Pam Laffin, the anti-authority. Pam Laffin was the star of a series of anti-smoking TV ads that were broadcast in the mid-1990s. Laffin is not a celebrity, and she's not a health expert. She's a smoker. At the time, Laffin was a 29-year-old mother of 2. She had started smoking at age 10 and had developed emphysema by age 24. She'd suffered a failed lung transplant. Greg Connolly, the director of tobacco control for the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, MDPH, was in charge of designing a public service campaign against smoking. He became aware of Pam Laffin and asked her to share her story with the public. She agreed. Connolly said, "What we've learned from previous campaigns is that telling stories using real people is the most compelling way." The MDPH filmed a series of 30-second spots, broadcast during hip shows such as Ally McBeal and Dawson's Creek. The spots were brutal. They showed Laffin battling to live while slowly suffocating because of her failing lungs. The TV audience watched her enduring an invasive bronchoscopy, a procedure in which a tube with a camera at the end is inserted through the mouth and pushed into the lungs. The spots showed the nasty surgical scars on her back. In another spot, featuring photos of Laffin as a child and as an adult, she talks about how her emphysema left her with a fat face and a hump on my neck. She said, "I started smoking to look older, and I'm sorry to say it worked." The spots were difficult to watch and contrasted jarringly with the light soap opera fare of shows like Dawson's Creek. "We have no compunction at all about shocking smokers into waking up," Connolly said. Laffin became a heroine of the anti-smoking movement. She was the subject of an MTV documentary. The Centers for Disease Control features her story in an anti-smoking web campaign and a 20-minute educational video titled, "I Can't Breathe." She died in November 2000 at the age of 31, 3 weeks before she was scheduled for a second lung transplant. After hearing Laffin's story, you're probably not surprised that she was an effective spokeswoman. There's no question that she knew from personal experience what she was talking about. She had a powerful tale to tell. Another example of drawing credibility from anti-authorities comes from the Doe Fund in New York City, an organization that takes homeless men, the John Does of our society, and turns them into productive citizens through counseling, drug rehabilitation, and most important, job training. A few years ago, some representatives from a grant organization, potential financial supporters, were going to visit the offices of the Doe Fund. The Doe Fund sent a driver, Dennis, to pick them up and drive them to the home office. Dennis had been homeless before he turned to the Doe Fund for help. During the 45-minute car trip, Dennis shared his story with the grant representatives. One commented, "We weren't just sitting around listening to a bunch of directors telling us how effective their services are. Dennis was the best ambassador that the Doe Fund could provide. He was living proof." The Doe Fund also uses this principle internally. Every homeless man who enters the program is matched with a mentor who, 2 years before, was in the same situation. It's worth reminding ourselves that it wasn't obvious that Laffin or Dennis would be effective authorities. 30 years ago, an anti-smoking campaign like Laffin's would probably not have happened. Instead, the Surgeon General would have given us a stern lecture on the dangers of smoking, or Burt Reynolds would have extolled the virtues of a smoke-free life. A citizen of the modern world, constantly inundated with messages, learns to develop skepticism about the sources of those messages. Who's behind these messages? Should I trust them? What do they have to gain if I believe them? A commercial claiming that a new shampoo makes your hair bouncier has less credibility than hearing your best friend rave about how a new shampoo made her own hair bouncier. Well, duh. The company wants to sell you shampoo. Your friend doesn't, so she gets more trust points. The takeaway is that it can be the honesty and trustworthiness of our sources, not their status, that allows them to act as authorities. Sometimes anti-authorities are even better than authorities. The power of details. We don't always have an external authority who can vouch for our message. Most of the time, our messages have to vouch for themselves. They must have internal credibility. Of course, internal credibility frequently depends on what topic we're discussing. A credible math proof looks different from a credible movie review. But surprisingly, there are some general principles for establishing internal credibility. To see these principles in action, we can again turn to urban legends. The boyfriend's death is a famous urban legend that begins with a couple heading out on a date in the boyfriend's car. The car runs out of gas under a tree on a deserted road. The girl suspects that the guy is faking in order to make out with her, but soon she realizes they're really stuck. The boyfriend decides to walk to the nearest house for help, and the girl stays behind. He has been gone for a long time. It feels like hours. And the girl is frightened by a creepy scratching coming from the roof of the car, possibly the scrapings of a low-hanging tree branch. After several hours of anxious waiting, the girl gets out of the car to discover, cue the horror music, her boyfriend murdered and hanging from the tree above the car. His toes scrape the roof as he swings in the wind. When people pass this legend along, they always add particular details. It's always set in a specific location, which varies when it is told in different parts of the country. It happened right off Farm Road 121. It happened right on top of that bluff over Lake Travis. An expert on folk legends, Jan Brunvand, says that legends acquire a good deal of their credibility and effect from their localized details. A person's knowledge of details is often a good proxy for her expertise. Think of how a history buff can quickly establish her credibility by telling an interesting Civil War anecdote. But concrete details don't just lend credibility to the authorities who provide them. They lend credibility to the idea itself. The Civil War anecdote, with lots of interesting details, is credible in anyone's telling. By making a claim tangible and concrete, details make it seem more real, more believable. Jurors and the Darth Vader toothbrush. In 1986, Jonathan Shedler and Melvin Manis, researchers at the University of Michigan, created an experiment to simulate a trial. Subjects were asked to play the role of jurors and were given the transcript of a fictitious trial to read. The jurors were asked to assess the fitness of a mother, Mrs. Johnson, and to decide whether her 7-year-old son should remain in her care. The transcript was constructed to be closely balanced. There were 8 arguments against Mrs. Johnson and 8 arguments for Mrs. Johnson. All the jurors heard the same arguments. The only difference was the level of detail in those arguments. In one experimental group, all the arguments that supported Mrs. Johnson had some vivid detail, whereas the arguments against her had no extra details. They were pallid by comparison. The other group heard the opposite combination. As an example, one argument in Mrs. Johnson's favor said, "Mrs. Johnson sees to it that her child washes and brushes his teeth before bedtime." In the vivid form, the argument added a detail. "He uses a Star Wars toothbrush that looks like Darth Vader." An argument against Mrs. Johnson was, "The child went to school with a badly scraped arm, which Mrs. Johnson had not cleaned or attended to. The school nurse had to clean the scrape." The vivid form added the detail that, as the nurse was cleaning the scrape, she spilled mercurochrome on herself, staining her uniform red. The researchers carefully tested the arguments with and without vivid details to ensure that they had the same perceived importance. The details were designed to be irrelevant to the judgment of Mrs. Johnson's worthiness. It mattered that Mrs. Johnson didn't attend to the scraped arm. It didn't matter that the nurse's uniform got stained in the process. But even though the details shouldn't have mattered, they did. Jurors who heard the favorable arguments with vivid details judged Mrs. Johnson to be a more suitable parent, 5.8 out of 10, than did jurors who heard the unfavorable arguments with vivid details, 4.3 out of 10. The details had a big impact. We can take comfort, perhaps, in the fact that the swing wasn't more dramatic. If the mother's fitness had dropped from 8 to 2, we might have had to worry a bit about our justice system. But the jurors did make different judgments based on irrelevant, vivid details. So, why did the details make a difference? They boosted the credibility of the argument. If I can mentally see the Darth Vader toothbrush, it's easier for me to picture the boy diligently brushing his teeth in the bathroom, which in turn reinforces the notion that Mrs. Johnson is a good mother. What we should learn from urban legends and the Mrs. Johnson trial is that vivid details boost credibility. But what should also be added is that we need to make use of truthful core details. We need to identify details that are as compelling and human as the Darth Vader toothbrush, but more meaningful, details that symbolize and support our core idea. In 2004, 2 Stanford Business School professors held a workshop with arts organizations in Washington, D.C. One exercise was designed to make the arts leaders focus on the enduring principles of their organizations. the principles they would not compromise under any circumstances. One organization at the workshop was the Liz Lerman Dance Exchange, LLDE, a company of dance artists that creates, performs, teaches, and engages people in making art. At the workshop, the leaders from the LLDE maintained that one of their core values was diversity. "Come on," scoffed one of the professors, suspecting an exaggeration. "Everyone claims that they value diversity, but you're a dance company. You're probably filled with a bunch of 25-year-old dancers, all of them tall and thin. Some of them are probably people of color, but is that diversity?" Other people in the audience, unfamiliar with the LLDE, nodded at this skeptical response. Peter DeMuro, the artistic director of the LLDE, responded with an example. "As a matter of fact," he said, "the longest-term member of our company is a 73-year-old man named Thomas Dwyer. He came to the LLDE after a full career working for the U.S. government when he retired in 1988 and had no previous dance experience. He has now been with the LLDE for 17 years. This detail, 73-year-old Thomas Dwyer, silenced the skepticism in the room. The professors experienced a rare moment of speechlessness. And there was a good reason that DeMuro could respond quickly with a vivid example. "The reason is that diversity truly is a core value at the LLDE. It's part of the LLDE's organizational DNA." In 2002, Liz Lerman won a MacArthur Genius Grant for her work creating modern dance involving communities throughout the United States. In a dance project called Hallelujah USA, Lerman visited communities across the country and asked residents what made them thankful. Then, she choreographed dances around those themes of praise. The final performance featured members of the local community, teenage female Hmong dancers in Minneapolis, border collie owners in Virginia, and a group of six card-playing ladies from Burlington, Vermont, who'd missed only two of their weekly card games in 40 years. Now, a brief aside to the eye-rolling skeptics out there, to whom a modern dance performance sounds as appealing as being buried alive. Whether or not you'd like to spend your weekends watching the gyrations of border collie owners, you've got to admit that the LLDE is diverse. It's real diversity, not workspeak diversity. The example of Thomas Dwyer, the 73-year-old former government employee, is a vivid concrete symbol of a core organization value. It's a symbol both to supporters and to the dancers themselves. No one wants to participate in a dance project and be the only balding middle-aged guy on a stage full of twiggies. The LLDE's claim that diversity was a core value gained credibility from the details of Dwyer's example, rather than from an external source. Beyond war. The use of vivid details is one way to create internal credibility, to weave sources of credibility into the idea itself. Another way is to use statistics. Since grade school, we've been taught to support our arguments with statistical evidence. But statistics tend to be eye-glazing. How can we use them while still managing to engage our audience? Jeff Inskow and other leaders of the Beyond War movement in the 1980s were determined to find a way to address the following paradox. When we see a child running with scissors, we wince. We shout at her to stop. Yet, when we read newspaper articles about nuclear weapons, which have the power to destroy millions of children, it provokes, at best, only a moment of dismay. Beyond War was started by a group of citizens who were alarmed by the arms race between the United States and the Soviet Union. At this point, the combined Soviet and American nuclear arsenals were sufficient to destroy the world multiple times. The Beyond War participants went door to door in their neighborhoods, hoping to galvanize a public outcry against the arms race. They struggled with the problem of how to make credible their belief that the arms race was out of control. How do you make clear to people the staggering destructive capability of the world's nuclear stockpile? It's so intangible, so invisible. And yet, telling stories or providing details seems inadequate. Grappling with the nuclear arms race requires us to grapple with the scale of it. Scale relies on numbers. Beyond War would arrange house parties in which a host family invited a group of friends and neighbors over, along with a Beyond War representative to speak to them. Ainscow recounts a simple demonstration that the group used in its presentations. He always carried a metal bucket to the gatherings. At the appropriate point in the presentation, he'd take a BB out of his pocket and drop it into the empty bucket. The BB made a loud clatter as it ricocheted and settled. Ainscow would say, "This is the Hiroshima bomb." Then, he spent a few minutes describing the devastation of the Hiroshima bomb, the miles of flattened buildings, the tens of thousands killed immediately, the larger number of people with burns or other long-term health problems. Next, he dropped 10 BBs into the bucket. The clatter was louder and more chaotic. "This is the firepower of the missiles on one U.S. or Soviet nuclear submarine," he'd say. Finally, he asked the attendees to close their eyes. He'd say, "This is the world's current arsenal of nuclear weapons." Then he poured 5,000 BBs into the bucket, one for every nuclear warhead in the world. The noise was startling, even terrifying. "The roar of the BBs went on and on," said Ainscow. "Afterward, there was always dead silence." This approach is an ingenious way to convey a statistic. Let's unpack it a bit. First, Beyond War had a core belief. The public needs to wake up and do something about the arms race. Second, the group's members determined what was unexpected about the message. Everyone knew that the world's nuclear arsenal had grown since World War II, but no one realized the scale of the growth. Third, they had a statistic to make their belief credible, i.e., that the world had 5,000 nuclear warheads when a single one was enough to decimate a city. But the problem was that the number 5,000 means very little to people. The trick was to make this large number meaningful. The final twist was the demonstration, the bucket and the BBs, which added a sensory dimension to an otherwise abstract concept. Furthermore, the demonstration was carefully chosen. BBs are weapons, and the sound of the BBs hitting the bucket was fittingly threatening. Notice something that may be counterintuitive. The statistic didn't stick. It couldn't possibly stick. No one who saw the demonstration would remember a week later that there were 5,000 nuclear warheads in the world. What did stick was the sudden visceral awareness of a huge danger. The massive scale-up from World War II's limited atomic weaponry to the present worldwide arsenal. It was irrelevant whether there were 4,135 nuclear warheads or 9,437. The point was to hit people in the gut with the realization that this was a problem that was out of control. This is the most important thing to remember about using statistics effectively. Statistics are rarely meaningful in and of themselves. Statistics will and should almost always be used to illustrate a relationship. It's more important for people to remember the relationship than the number. The human scale principle. Another way to bring statistics to life is to contextualize them in terms that are more human, more everyday. As a scientific example, contrast the following two statements. 1. Scientists recently computed an important physical constraint to an extraordinary accuracy. To put the accuracy in perspective, imagine throwing a rock from the sun to the earth and hitting the target within one-third of a mile of dead center. 2. Scientists recently computed an important physical constraint to an extraordinary accuracy. To put the accuracy in perspective, imagine throwing a rock from New York to Los Angeles and hitting the target within two-thirds of an inch of dead center. Which statement seems more accurate? As you may have guessed, the accuracy levels in both questions are exactly the same, but when different groups evaluated the two statements, 58% of the respondents ranked the statistic about the sun to the earth as very impressive. That jumped to 83% for the statistic about New York to Los Angeles. We have no human experience, no intuition about the distance between the sun and the earth. The distance from New York to Los Angeles is much more tangible, though frankly it's still far from tangible. The problem is that if you make the distance more tangible, like a football field, then the accuracy becomes intangible. Throwing a rock the distance of a football field to an accuracy of 3.4 microns doesn't help. Stephen Covey, in his book, The Eighth Habit, describes a poll of 23,000 employees drawn from a number of companies and industries. He reports the poll's findings. Only 37% said they have a clear understanding of what their organization is trying to achieve and why. Only 1 in 5 was enthusiastic about their team's and their organization's goals. Only 1 in 5 said they had a clear line of sight between their tasks and their team's and organization's goals. Only 15% felt their organization fully enables them to execute key goals. Only 20% fully trusted the organization they work for. Pretty sobering stuff. It's also pretty abstract. You probably walk away from these stats thinking something like, there's a lot of dissatisfaction and confusion in most companies. Then Covey superimposes a very human metaphor over the statistics. He says, if, say, a soccer team had these same scores, only 4 of 11 players on the field would know which goal is theirs. Only 2 of the 11 would care. Only 2 of the 11 would know what position they play and know exactly what they are supposed to do, and all but 2 players would in some way be competing against their own team members rather than the opponent. The soccer analogy generates a human context for the statistics. It creates a sense of drama and a sense of movement. We can't help but imagine the actions of the 2 players trying to score a goal being opposed at every stage by the rest of their team. Why does the analogy work? It relies on our schema of soccer teams and the fact that this schema is somehow cleaner, more well-defined than our schemas of organizations. It's more vivid to think of a lack of cooperation on a soccer team, where teamwork is paramount, than in a corporation. And this is exactly Covey's point. Corporations should operate like teams, but they don't. Humanizing the statistics gives the argument greater wallop. As another example of the human scale principle, take a mundane situation. Figuring out whether a particular technological upgrade is worth the money. One example comes from Cisco, when it had to decide whether to add a wireless network for its employees. The cost of maintaining a wireless network was estimated at $500 per year per employee. That price sounds hefty, on the order of adding dental or vision insurance for all employees. But it's not a benefit. It's an investment. So how do you compute the value of an investment? You've got to decide whether you can get $501 worth of additional value from each employee each year after adding the network. One Cisco employee figured out a better way to think about the investment. If you believe you can increase an employee's productivity by 1 or 2 minutes a day, you paid back the cost of wireless. On this scale, the investment is much easier to assess. Our intuition works at this scale. We can easily simulate scenarios where employees can save a few minutes from wireless access. For instance, sending someone a request for a forgotten document during a critical meeting. Statistics aren't inherently helpful. It's the scale and the context that make them so. Not many people have an intuition about whether wireless networking can generate $500 worth of marginal value per employee per year. The right scale changes everything. We saw that concreteness allows people to bring their knowledge to bear. Remember HP's simulation of a family at Disney World? Similarly, the human scale principle allows us to bring our intuition to bear in assessing whether the content of a message is credible. Statistics are a good source of internal credibility when they are used to illustrate relationships. In the introduction of this book, we discussed the example of the CSPI's campaign against saturated fat-loaded movie popcorn. The relevant statistic was that a medium-sized bag of popcorn